Acts chapter 27, verse 1. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship of Adramidium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia, one Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul, and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. So Paul and his two companions begin their journey to Rome. Again, the reference to Augustus. It is a more common reference than might be supposed. There were, according to some historical sources, there were more than one cohort with that designation. Meaning a legion was made up of several cohorts. From legion to legion, you would find of, you know, the 53rd Legion, the Augustus cohort. Of the 59th Legion, the Augustus cohort. It was not a unique designation, and it does not mean necessarily that they were the personal cohort of Augustus, this being well past Augustus's time. Verse 4. And when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. So sailing under Cyprus, because the winds would not allow them to sail along the coast of Asia Minor as they had intended, they eventually came to the city of Lycia, where they changed ships so they can make the full journey to Rome. Verse 7. And when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete over against Salmon. And hardly passing it, came to a place which is called the Fair Havens. Nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia. Again, there are a lot of scholars who have done works tracing the journeys of Paul, the missionary journeys, the journey to Rome, and as a commentator, I really don't think it's my job to do for you what you could easily do for yourself. I mean, especially these days, with the internet being accessible to people in all walks of life and all over the world even, you know, it's very easy to look up the journeys of Paul, if you're so inclined, and find the exact tracing of that journey. But again, our focus is mainly on doctrine, and that's why chapters like this I cover very briefly, and without a lot of detail, because I'm not a student of ancient geography, and therefore I can't speak as any sort of authority on the subject. Even these names translated into English give me some difficulty. Verse 9. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them, and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. And again, calendars is not my forte either, but based on the information I have, this would be early October. We're coming into, I guess, what would be storm season. It's now dangerous sailing. Verse 11. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. So again, while the centurion is pleased to deal kindly with Paul, he is also more inclined to believe the sailor and the owner of the ship. There's another motive that he may not be seeing, which is the profit motive. Paul wants to get to Rome. He himself had appealed to Caesar. He wanted to go to Caesar. He wanted to go to Rome. But they have a profit motive. Get one more in before the storm season sets in. October is still not November, right? But things start to get rough. And the master and owner, having gotten through some storm seasons, think, hey, we'll, you know, push it again. And, you know, every year's profit is going to be determined based on how many journeys you can make with a ship, how much cargo you can haul. And so they are willing to press forward and to risk it. Verse 12. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phenis, and there to winter, which is in haven of Crete, and lieth toward the southwest and northwest. If they could get to the other end of the island, that would be good, you know, to overwinter at that point. The city they're now near is not a really a good place to spend the winter. It's not very commodious in whatever capacity that was meaningful to them. Not nice enough lodgings, whatever. Verse 13. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euryclidon. And when the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. And running under a certain island, which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat. And these are nautical expressions. We let her drive. That is the precise nautical terminology for when you let a boat do that. Let the wind take it. The Euryclidon, but from the description, this is a hurricane, which is not uncommon in those waters. Anyways, in the midst of all this, it's very difficult for them to control the boat, to come by or master the boat. Verse 17, which when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, strake sail, and so were driven. Again, these would be shoals and sandbanks, which they would be afraid that the ship would run aground in. And then part of what saves a ship in a lot of those storms is the ability to go with it, to be able to run with the winds and to ride out the storm. And in fact, I do believe that a lot of times more damage happens to ships which are moored at the shore. And I'm not a sailing man. I've read books on sailing and stuff, but that's really not enough. But I believe I've heard in news reports and stuff, oftentimes that's the case. And so you can imagine, though, a ship that is stuck in the sand and then the wind and the waves battering it, instead of going with the waves and the wind, it would be broken apart and destroyed. So they don't want to go anywhere where they're going to get stuck. And what they're doing here is they're running cables underneath the ship. You know, they would wrap cables around the ship to prevent it from breaking up and to create extra stability. Obviously, when there's no storm, you don't want ropes running around your ship because it would decrease the streamlineness of the vessel and cause it to lose speed. But in this case, it would be more important to keep the ship together, give it extra strength. Verse 18, and we being exceedingly tossed with the tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. And the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. Everyone's beginning to lose hope. And you know that it can only take so much before it'll just sink or be capsized or break on a rock. I mean, your luck runs out. You know, you run it out 3, 4, 5 days of a storm. It's very easy to begin to believe, you know, we're done for. Verse 21, but after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, Sirs, you should have hearkened unto me and not have loosed from Crete and to have gained this harm and loss. And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer. For I believe God, that it shall be even as it was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island. So in other words, we're going to make shipwreck. Ship's going to be lost. We're going to crash, but your lives will be spared. So be of good cheer. This is not the end of your life, but rather just the end of our journey. But Paul, you know, is inspiring the men to courage. And fear not, based on what God has summoned him to do. You know, every man who has a family who serves God, I think, would take comfort in these sort of things. And also in other passages, where thou and all thy house, you know, sometimes when we serve the Lord, and we try to give good counsel. You know, those around us, you know, they're not always as persuaded or fully aware of things as we may be. But oftentimes the Lord will give us the lives of those around us. And hopefully through that, when they see that God is with you, it will provoke them to faith. In the New Testament, there are a lot of sort of storm images. When Jesus walked on the water, when his disciples were in the ship and the storm and the wind was blowing. Or when he was asleep in the ship and the storm and the winds were blowing. And here we have a storm and winds. You know, in the midst of troubles, the Lord rebuked his disciples when they feared and they didn't trust him. And now we have the Apostle Paul also put into a storm and trouble. And through his faith, and that others might see his faith, their lives are preserved. You know, we see when we keep the faith, the Lord blesses us and those around us. You know, that when we can learn not to fear whatever trouble might come, you know, when we've gone through our storms and our troubles and we've learned to trust the Lord, you know, that can be a great testimony to anyone around us who can observe it. Now, how do you keep such a cool head in the midst of all that trouble? How do you do that? And we are to be ready to give a reason, an answer to any man who should ask concerning the hope that lies in us. We want to be able to give reason and explain why we hope, why we have such great confidence. And I don't think it requires a lot of deep theological understanding. Sometimes it's just very simple. It's God who carried me through the storm and tempest before. I trust him to carry me through it again. And even if I should fall, because I've learned to trust him, I know that he will raise me up. Even raise me from the dead. And so I have nothing to fear. And Paul knew he had a purpose. He was going to Rome. I'm going to Rome. He thought they should have listened to him. Of course, they could have saved their ship. But in the dream, the Lord revealed to him that their lives would be spared. Verse 27, but when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, about midnight the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country, and sounded, and found it 20 fathoms. Sounding is the process where you take a depth. How deep is the water? So they sounded, they were at 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again, and found it 15 fathoms. The water's getting more shallow. Then, fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. I don't know how much a fathom is. I mean, that's another one of those things can easily be looked up if that's the kind of detail you're interested in. And there's nothing wrong with looking into those things and being well instructed in those things. But of course, the most profitable kind of knowledge is the kind of knowledge that leads us to the right measure of righteousness in our lives, right? There's a certain measure we want. We want to measure up to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. The measure of how many feet are in a fathom, while somewhat interesting, is nothing for us to get puffed up about. And even the righteousness which we have in God is nothing to be puffed up about. I remember when I first introduced the idea of holiness and righteousness being something we ought to go after and seek to obtain in this life, it was commented to me that, well, then you'd be proud. And of course, well, that wouldn't be righteous, would it? You know, one need not be proud because we know that our righteousness is wrought of God. It's the work of God in us. I mean, does the cross of Christ cause pride to rise up in my heart? Look what I did. I put Jesus on the cross. Now all the sins are forgiven. No, I mean, there's no reason for me to be proud of it. But I am glad to magnify and honor God because of it. Verse 30, and as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea, under color, as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship. Under color means, like, actually pretense. What they did is they were sort of making as if they would they're going to do, you know, cast the anchors out. They were sort of pretending that, but what they were actually planning on doing was sort of getting away from the ship. Verse 31, Paul said unto the centurion and to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. Well, you guys can't be saved unless they stay here. We can't have the sailors running off and living with just a bunch of soldiers. And notice he did not say we, he said ye, because Paul knows he's going to Rome. He doesn't know about them. But obviously there's some conditions that have to be met. No one's going to die, right? If they believe his word, if they panic and start throwing themselves into the sea, they very well may die. But their lives are given over to Paul. And he says, if these escape, you can't be saved. Now, this is as good a time as any to mention that the King James use of the word ye, as I said there, is basically equivalent to you guys. It is you plural. We don't have a plural form of you. In modern English, we just say you. But the ancient languages in which the scriptures were written did have plural forms of you. And actually that comes into play often in the prophets. If it weren't for that, it would be occasionally difficult to figure out who was being addressed. But with the use of ye in the King James, it is very clear to see when the second person plural is being used. And so that's one of those areas in which the King James actually can be quite useful if you understand the way the language is used. Verse 32, then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall out. No going off in the lifeboats. Verse 33, and while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, saying, this day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. Basically, during all the storm, they haven't really been eating. 34, wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you. You know, it's not a point of life or death anymore. Just eat. A lot of times, you know, when you're facing a life or death situation, what's the point of sitting down and having a meal? You might be dead in 10 minutes. But Paul's saying you're going to live, so eat. You need to have strength. Again, there shall not a hair fall from the head of any of you. Right there, I just wanted to comment in passing. This is why we should not be literalists and interpret the Bible in a literal sense. Because hairs fall from the body every single day. That's not what Paul means. It's an idiom. You know, the Bible has idioms and figures of speech in it, which are not supposed to be taken literally. Not one hair on your head is just a figure of speech. It's a hyperbole, which means you will not come to harm. It can make interpreting the Bible sometimes a little difficult. When am I looking at an idiom? When am I looking at a figure of speech? When should I take it literally? But let this serve as an example of how we have to consider whether or not we should be interpreting something literally. I know there are some people who would like to tell me that, hey, you know, this was literally true, that these people, not even one hair, when they got thrown overboard in the sea and all that, and they came up on land, not even one single hair of their body literally fell off, or perished, as it says. And that's just not even what Paul means, okay? That's not what he means. It's not to be taken literally. The point is well taken, I'm sure, by them, that a hair, what is the effect of losing a hair? Nothing. It's a very small injury. It's not even really an injury, of course. But that's the point, is you won't even be in the least injured by this. And actually, I don't know if that's exactly correct. It could even pass over the idea of injury. But the idea, because the word fall is literally perish. I mean, you will not be lost. And it indicates sort of none of you are going to die. That's for sure. Now, I don't want to read too much into the idiom either. Anyways, verse 35. And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. And we were in all the ship 260 and 16 souls. 276 people on board. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. So there's still a few things left on board. Throw the last of it out. Verse 39, and when it was day, they knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore, into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. So they didn't know where they were, but they could see there was a creek there, and they thought, let's get in there. 40. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea, and loosed the rudder bands, and hoisted up the mainsail to the wind, and made toward shore. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. So they got stuck in nose first into a sandbank, and the back is beginning to be broken up. Verse 42, and the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. So the centurion did not want Paul to be killed. And so all the prisoners ended up being spared. I don't know how many prisoners there were. They didn't explain exactly that. Maybe not necessarily a lot of them. You know, how many prisoners would you have to transport from Judea to Rome in a given year? I mean, it probably wouldn't have been a lot. Maybe they had picked up other prisoners along the way. If I missed that detail, if that detail was given some point in this chapter, I must have missed it. But I did not notice that. Anyways, they've wrecked the ship, and now they are on land.